Well, as Nathan said, it's an interesting reading from the gospel that falls for this Sunday. So when I was preparing, I did have a bit of a deja vu, so much so that I had to check my notes on my previous visits with you. And when I did look at my notes, I realized why I had this feeling that I've done this before, because indeed, the first time you invited me to preach was early November 2 years ago around All Saints. And not only that, but the gospel text said for that Sunday was on marriage and divorce and eunuchs from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 19. 2 years on, we're another gospel, but a similar theme. Jesus questioned over issues related to marriage. Well, as it happens, I've been thinking about that subject for a while. So here it is, once again. It has become part of my ministry to help churches to think over these issues in their own mission and self-understanding, not the least because of how easily we, people who call themselves Christians, can sell out to whatever the dominant culture around us tells us makes for a good life, happy life. And in our Christian version, such vision of a good life very easily becomes God's blessing or even God's will, but scratch a little deeper and you realize there is quite a disconnect, if not a clash, between our understanding of God's greatest blessings for our earthly life and the picture that is drawn in the New Testament. A lot of it has to do with putting marriage and kids at the center of it all, something that Jesus clearly talks about in today's passage. But allow me for a moment to paint a broad brush picture as we recall some of the other things Jesus has said on the subject. One of the quotes from him: whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and even life itself cannot be my disciple. Or when his mother and brothers ask if they could see him, and when his family think he's crazy or demon-possessed, he says, who are my mother? Who are my brothers? Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. Why? Why say such unsettling words, especially ones about hating your own family? And we may have heard these verses many times before. We also may have heard some reasonable explanations about what's meant by words such as hate. But if we're honest, there's just no way of denying that they are harsh. And if they sound harsh to us, then we have no idea how scandalous, how shocking these words would have been in Jesus' own culture. If you and I had lived at the same time and in the same place as Jesus, then our family and our household we belonged to would have been the center of our identity, an assurance of our livelihood, our food and our roof over our heads, and an equivalent of our pension. Everything revolved around family. Mind you, that family would have been much, much bigger. You would have likely had lots of brothers and sisters. And your bond with them would have been really, really important throughout your whole life, no matter your age. Your blood links, your commitment to your brothers and sisters, your father and mother, all the people to whom you were now related through various marriage links, they would have been the most important bond you had. Your family, protecting its honor, would be always your sacred duty. And into this kind of a world comes Jesus, who, when told that his own blood relations are wanting to see him publicly says the words to the effect of, "You here who are following me, you are more important to me than my own flesh and blood." No wonder his family thought that Jesus was out of his mind. Now, of course, if we've been living with the gospel stories even for a bit, then we'll know that in his ministry, Jesus wasn't known for rejecting human love and care for those nearest and dearest. We remember how he raised the little girl of Jairus, his daughter, with Talitha Kum, how he insisted on the protection of the powerless and vulnerable, and said that a wife couldn't be discarded when a man decided he was no longer interested in her and wanted to divorce her. Because again, in Jesus' culture, only men could divorce, while women were simply transferred from the authority of one man to another, and their value really depended on their ability to bear children. And as he was dying on the cross, Jesus made sure that his own mother, most likely a widow at that point, would be provided for. So Jesus is not a crazed lunatic bent on destroying loving relationships and protections for those who couldn't survive on their own. What he's doing, he's extending the strict borders drawn by blood and marriage lines, and he's after a much bigger family that is being created by none other than God. And anyone could join this family, he said. Everyone was to be welcome as a new sister or brother, whatever their economic or social or marital status. Which they did, all kinds of people, to the dismay and outrage of those who watched. And what has been really astounding to me is to notice how many, apparently single people, were associated with Jesus and his movement. It is possible that some of them were married, because that's what the absolute majority of the people were expected to be. But it's really unusual that they're not identified as such in our Gospels. And this is particularly true of women who follow Jesus. There are many women, and they range from patrons to prostitutes to widows. We could spend all day looking just at them. Jesus had a lot of time for widows. They often feature in his life and parables as tireless and faithful participants of the kingdom. He raises the only son of a widow at nine and tells a story of a persistent widow who prevails upon an unjust judge as a reminder of the justness of God. And then think of Mary Magdalene. Together with other women who had been healed by Jesus, she follows him and his disciples. Scandalous thing to do for a woman, and supports them out of her own resources. And then there are those two sisters of Lazarus, Mary and Martha, who seem to share a home together. And they invite Jesus to their home and have some of the most profound theological conversations with Jesus that are recorded in our scriptures. Perhaps one of the most puzzling stories about Jesus and women and marriage is our gospel reading for today, recording an exchange between Jesus and the Sadducees, the religious and political Jewish elite of the time. Luke, the evangelist, reminds us that they were at the skeptical end of the religious spectrum. So in contrast to the Pharisees, they didn't believe in such things as spiritual beings or life after death. Well, Jesus clearly did. So the Sadducees decide to set a trap for Jesus, based on the following question: if there is such a thing as the resurrection from the dead at the end of time, then who will be married to whom in this complicated case of one woman who had married seven brothers, one after another? If you're new to the world of the Bible, you may wonder about this business of this childless woman being passed on to the deceased husband's brother and then another brother and so on. But this was a way of honoring and preserving the dead man's name by giving him an heir through his own brother and taking care of the widow too. Letting the family line continue, preserving one's name. And so preserving one's family story was all that really mattered. Or one thing that mattered a lot. To put it in a slightly more blunt language, the question the Sadducees are asking Jesus is, who will own a childless woman who had been serially married to seven brothers during her lifetime? And here is how Luke records Jesus' response. Those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they're like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. And this might sound quite perplexing, if not upsetting, to some of us. In fact, some of us might think to ourselves, if life here on earth is one's only chance to experience marriage, then we better make sure we don't miss out, right? And that is part of the issue that I'm so interested in. Our understanding of happiness is so tightly connected to the idea of coupledom that coupleless idea of heaven may not sound that palatable even. We often simply cannot fathom anything even better than being part of a couple, than being part of a nuclear family, than having marriage, because marriage or being in a committed romantic relationship has become an epitome of personal happiness in our culture, in our world. Yet this passage suggests transformed relationships, which are all about the new family of God is creating. Family which already is being created, even at this age. A family which is not based on romantic commitment and where people are neither owned nor passed around if they fail their fertility test. So the hypothetical woman from the Sadducees story need not worry as to whom she will be assigned to in life to come. Patriarchal arrangement, which her marriage is reflected, will be no more. There will be no more death, and therefore no need to continue family name through giving birth. That's what it is to live like angels. And all of that is not a matter only of life ahead, but there were to be glimpses of this heavenly life already here on this earth. The early Christians grasped this in their own efforts to live out Jesus' vision of a new world being created by God. A significant number of them were really caught by this vision of living like angels. And one of the ways they try to do that is by refraining from marriage. We have a record of one of the church fathers, Cyprian, writing to them these words. That which we shall be, you have already begun to be. You already possess the glory of the resurrection. You pass through the world without contagion, like angels of God. Well, I'm not sure they always got it right, these early Christians. And given their own culture, many of them decided that striving to become like angels and refraining from marriage was all about celibacy and renouncing the body and keeping your body pure, so to speak. But a vision of an alternative path of life, not one based on marriage and children, was quite remarkable. And even more remarkably, it was now available to all Christians, including women, giving them freedom, which was almost never possible within the constraints of marriage and childbearing at that time in that culture. So no wonder that the early Christians were called the haters of the human race and persecuted as the destroyers of family and society norms. But here's the thing. When these Christians, on the first centuries of the Christian era, when they referred to each other as brothers and sisters, they really meant it. This was their new family, the most important connection in their lives, whatever was to become of their blood links, whatever was to become of their marriages or refraining from marriage. And if we look at the stories of those early Christians, we see how different they are. Sometimes the whole household would embrace the way of Jesus, in which case their own house would become a center of Christian community life. Many others, allegiance to the Christian faith literally meant leaving their structure of life and identity and becoming totally dependent on an alternative support system, the church. So at the very least, these words of Jesus challenge us to take seriously what we seem to be claiming every time we call each other brothers and sisters, siblings in Christ. It challenges our understanding of what we do when we gather together to worship God. It prompts us to ask ourselves, how are we to be a true Christian family, whatever our marital status or the size of our household? How are we to be a family, it asks us. How are we to be a family to those who are on their own or attend church on their own? And how are we to be family to our own nuclear families within the church? Indeed, how are our biological families, our adopted families, our marriages, and our child raising, all of them, to be transformed in light of this new reality, new kingdom, new family that God is creating? What does it mean for the shape of our weeks and months and years? What does it say about how often we might be gathering in some shape or form as a whole church or just a few believers here and there? What does it mean for our dinner tables and who would be welcome and invited there? What does it mean for how we use our time and our financial resources? These are difficult, challenging questions if we take them seriously. And if they feel like challenging questions, if they feel countercultural, then yes, that's what they are. They were in Jesus' time, and they still are now. That is my wish and my prayer for all of us today, that alone and together we might know we belong to the family of God. And my prayer is that in this family, even now, we may glimpse what it means to be like angels. Whether we happen to be married or single, whatever our age, whether we have children or not, may we all glimpse what it means to live like the children of God and what it means to be the children of the resurrection. Amen.